was like, keep your toothbrush handy and your medication and be ready to go.
A hotel owner near Sterling keeps a close watch on the fire for his guests. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, June 18th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Alaskans protest Shell's plans in the Chukchi Sea.
And we're saying no to Shell. You've got to keep the oil in the ground. What we're talking about here is extreme extractions.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Spinard Builder Supply. For more than 60 years, SBS has helped Alaskans build from ground to roof to everything in between. Spinard Builder Supply is here to build with you.
And by
Nana and Tech, partners in the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence.
A very small portion of the Card Street fire on the Kenai Peninsula is under control, and the evacuation notice for a couple of neighborhoods has been lifted. As KDLL's Shailen Cochran reports, the fires continue to move east into the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge and away from residential areas.
Every day it's getting more and more contained.
That's Terry Anderson, one of the public information officers for the Division of Forestry. He's been giving regular updates over lunch at the Sterling Community Center, and Thursday, there was finally some good news. In some of the neighborhoods that were evacuated, crews are now working on the smaller spot fires, and people can finally get back to their homes, at least for now.
There's a whole division of guys that work on that all day long, and they grit it. They walk back and forth and back and forth, and yeah, obviously you can miss it. It happens, but it's rare because that's what they're doing on a daily basis.
In all, more than 250 firefighters are working the Card Street fire, and it's the number one priority fire in the country right now. Crews caught a break Wednesday night as the wind pushed the now 9,000-acre fire into the wilderness of the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge. But Refuge Fire Management Officer Christy Bullock says this is not a situation where they want to simply let the fire burn itself out.
This is an unwanted fire. This fire has the potential, if it crosses the Sterling Highway with the right conditions, to actually come back into the north side of Sterling, and we absolutely do not want that to happen. So the goal is to stop the fire. There's just too much risk to communities.
About 20 miles away, over in Cooper Landing, residents were also breathing a bit easier, but still keeping a sharp eye on the 300-acre Juneau Lake fire and the even closer 100-acre Stetson Creek fire.
We're not going to burn, brother. Neither are your houses. Nothing's going to burn. Just those trees.
Thanks.
You heard it right here first, sir.
Yeah, okay, got it.
Dan Michaels is the general manager at the Kenai Princess Wilderness Lodge in Cooper Landing. And besides worrying about his own house, he's got nearly 200 guests who probably didn't see any of this in the travel brochures.
So, yeah, I mean, it's pretty much all the guests coming in. It was like,
keep your toothbrush handy and your medication and be ready to go. I mean, it's just, what do you do?
He says they have their own plan to get people out safely if the need arises. But those two fires are also being kept more or less in check. They're both the result of lightning strikes earlier in the week.
And then all of a sudden, crack. And that was that. That started it. It was everybody, they knew which one it was.
A Type 2 management team is on site for those fires and will take over operations on Friday. At least 40 additional firefighters are also expected. The Stetson Creek fire has been relying mostly on air support, as its position on a hillside makes fighting it from the ground much more difficult. There's no cost estimate on those two fires, but the Card Street fire is now running a tab of more than $160,000 a day, totaling just over $1 million since Monday. Reporting from Sterling, I'm Shailen Cochran.
Officials say the Sockeye fire burning near Willow is beginning to cooperate. Incident Commander Tom Kurth says the total acreage burning is just over 7,000, a slight drop from yesterday, although that's in part due to better mapping of the fire's perimeter. The full number of firefighters on scene is approaching 600. More than 100 property checks conducted by the borough yesterday revealed 26 homes destroyed, not including additional outbuildings or subdivisions that weren't safe to survey. So far, the state has spent about $1.3 million fighting the Sockeye fire. That number will rise once the full damage has been assessed. Several wildfires are burning in the interior, including a growing blaze east of Delta Junction. Division of Forestry spokesman Tim Mowry says the Healy Lake Fire made a major push west toward Delta beginning late Wednesday night and increased in size from 2,000 to up to 6,000 acres.
Sort of switched directions last night at around midnight, and it did bump up against the Tanana River, and it spotted across the Tanana River.
Mowry says officials are working today to get a more accurate map of how much the fire has grown. He credits firefighters with stopping the fire's advance across the river toward Delta.
Forestry personnel and volunteer fire departments with a load of hotshots that were in Delta, they responded. They had a couple bulldozers out there, and they were able to get these spot fires that spotted over into a stringer of spruce.
Mowry says an area of agricultural fields shields Delta from the fire area, but managers want to keep the flames east of the Tanana River. Firefighters are also working to protect recreational cabins along the lake. The uninhabited village of Healy Lake is on the opposite side of the water from the fires and is not threatened. Another lightning-caused wildfire well north of Healy Lake is being allowed to burn. Mowry says it's a matter of resources and priorities.
Fire is like on the border of a full and limited suppression area, and we're going to keep an eye on it, but we currently don't have the resources to address that fire and the fact that there's no structures threatened.
Meanwhile, the Tanana Slough Fire near Dot Lake is now 30% contained. The fire increased slightly to 718 total acres yesterday, but remains on an island in the Tanana River. A crowd of about 40 gathered in the drizzling rain outside of Juneau's federal building this afternoon to protest Royal Dutch Shell's oil rig, the Polar Pioneer. The vessel left Seattle on Monday after weeks of public outcry. KTOO's Elizabeth Jenkins has more.
This is a good one. Alaska Climate Action Network organizer Elaine Schroeder is passing out a rainbow of signs to people arriving at the rally. Handwritten slogans and splashes of yellow and blue.
Let's take a look at them. This says, Alaska Moms for a Renewable Future. There is no creature more dangerous than a mother bear protecting her cubs. Now that's one of our more adorable signs. But come over
Shell's
here
massive
me.
Oil rig, the Polar Pioneer, is now sailing to the Chukchi Sea. In May, the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management gave conditional approval to the company to start exploratory drilling this summer off Alaska's Arctic coast.
And we're saying no to Shell. You've got to keep the oil in the ground. What we're talking about here is extreme extractions.
Concerns from environmental groups include the likelihood of a spill, the impact on coastal native communities, and climate change.
We want renewable energy sources, and that's what our money should be going for.
In a statement, the Bureau on Ocean Energy Management says the Polar Pioneer will meet rigorous safety standards during its exploration. Some of the signs at the rally are taped to kayak paddles, a nod to the kayaktivist in Seattle. Lorena Guillen and her husband are Seattleites on vacation.
We're trying to see the glaciers before they disappear.
They were active in the protest down south, but weren't expecting to spend their trip this way. Then they saw a flyer in a heritage coffee shop.
It was like, yes, this is exactly the fight we need to continue and to not give up.
Mid-rally, a car swerves into a handicap spot. The vehicle has a large wood and paper structure strapped to the top. Elaine Schroeder explains.
Right now, what just drove by was a replica of the Polar Pioneer. Only we call it the Polar Profiteer rather than the Polar Pioneer.
Schroeder says the Polar Profiteer will make another appearance at the 4th of July parade, but the group hopes the Polar Pioneer doesn't make it to its next destination. In Juneau, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins.
Shell spokeswoman Megan Baldino says the company understands that there are individuals opposed to their plans for the summer. She says Shell asks people to voice their opposition safely and legally. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Willow resident finds his home intact, but everything else gone.
I lost my livelihood out there. All my hand tools, everything that I enjoy doing was demolished in the fire.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Did you know some cruise ships are allowed to discharge wastewater while anchored or tied up in port? State officials and industry representatives say it's safe, but critics fear it's fouling local harbors. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The Norwegian Pearl pulls up at one of Ketchikan's cruise ship berths. Many of its 2,400 passengers head out onto the docks. Toby Hatcher of Portland, Oregon is one. He says the ship encourages environmental awareness through recycling, low-flush toilets, and other means. A regular Alaska cruiser, he's aware of other efforts to control pollution. But he says he hasn't thought much about how this and other ships discharge what comes out of the floating city's toilets, sinks, and laundries.
Well, I guess I'd prefer them not to do it in general at all. However, if they were going to do it, I'd prefer them not to do it right here while they're docked.
But in fact, they do. The Pearl is one of a dozen large cruise ships allowed to discharge treated wastewater in Ketchikan, Juneau, and some other Alaska harbors this year. Six, including the Pearl, have permits covering treated sewage called Blackwater. Those ships, plus six others, also have permits to discharge kitchen, laundry, and shower runoff, known as graywater. The State Department of Environmental Conservation issues the permits for stationary discharges under new rules that took effect last summer.
It has to be treated wastewater through an advanced wastewater treatment system.
Environmental program specialist Ed White says that technology makes it possible to discharge while stationary. Some ships were even allowed to do it under an older, more restrictive permit system. That measured pollutants coming directly out of the ships. White says the new system allows samples to be taken after being diluted in what's called a mixing zone. That was proposed by former Governor Sean Parnell and approved by the legislature in 2013 at the urging of the industry.
We have some additional requirements for those ships that discharge while stationary. They have to take water samples both on board the ship and also in the water, what happens, you know, in that mixing zone.
The zone for most harbors is 90 yards from the point of discharge. That's about a third of the length of the Norwegian Pearl. White says the ships may be stationary, but tides and currents mean the water is not.
We do have some restrictions. For example, in Skagway, there's a dock where there would be an overlap, so they either can't discharge there or they get a much smaller mixing zone if they can meet those requirements.
The dozen ships were issued individual permits, while a new general permit system is on appeal.
We feel that this new general permit does do the citizens of Alaska and the clean water of Alaska a big disservice.
David Hafey is with the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council, the region's largest environmental group. He says new wastewater treatment systems are an improvement, but they're not good enough to protect fish, shellfish, and people.
Our research shows that Alaska would really be the only place in the entire world that would allow cruise ships of this size to dump those wastes and partially treated wastes while tied up to a dock.
The cruise industry disagrees.
The water really is virtually drinking water quality when it's discharged now from the vessels.
John Binkley is president of the Cruise Lines International Association's Alaska chapter. He says releasing treated wastewater in harbors poses no threat.
It's a pretty advanced system. The final process in there is sterilization of the water, similar to the use in hospitals and whatnot. And so it's really pretty pure water that comes out.
In addition to the 12 ships granted stationary discharge permits, another six are allowed to discharge while underway, which dilutes the waste further. In all, 18 ships have the okay to release wastewater this summer. White of the State Department of Environmental Conservation says another 14 don't.
Typically, about half the ships the last few years hold their wastewater and then treat it in whatever way they have and discharge it offshore.
That's beyond Alaska's regulatory reach. This is Ed Schoenfeld. reporting in Juneau.
There are less than 2 weeks to go before the traditional start of the summer king salmon trolling season on July 1st. But fishermen in Southeast don't know yet how many kings they'll be allowed to catch. Representatives on the Pacific Salmon Commission are deadlocked, and they can't agree on how many king salmon are out there. And that has put this year's king salmon season in jeopardy. KCAW's Rachel Waldholtz reports.
Normally, the King Salmon Abundance Index is released in early April. That number determines how many Chinook will be available for commercial and sport fishermen in Southeast Alaska, and how many fish must be allowed to pass by on their way to rivers in British Columbia, Washington, and Oregon. But here we are, with just days to go until the summer troll season starts, and that number isn't out, which means that fishermen and processors and fishery managers don't know what kind of a summer to plan for. The problem is at the Pacific Salmon Commission, which implements the U.S.-Canada Pacific Salmon Treaty. Each year, representatives from Alaska, Canada, Washington, and Oregon have to agree on an estimate of the returning king salmon population. And right now, they don't agree. 2014 was a record year for king salmon in Southeast, but when the abundance index was first calculated this year, it had dropped by 77%, according to Charlie Swanton, the Deputy Commissioner of Fish and Game and Alaska's representative on the Pacific Salmon Commission. Swanton says Alaska just doesn't agree with that number.
When you have a strong brood year, it doesn't drop off the cliff. Okay.
Last year's quota for Southeast was almost 440,000 king salmon. That's the highest since the current management system went into effect in 1999. But under the numbers produced by the model this year, there would have been about 240,000 king salmon available for fishermen. That's about half as many. Swanton says it's always possible that something drastic happened to the population in the intervening year, but there's evidence, including from a strong winter troll season, that indicates otherwise.
Everything that we've seen from the return to the Columbia River last year and the Columbia River returns so far this year are all pointing towards another year of very strong abundance.
And Southeast fishermen worry that with the lower quota, they might be forced to watch those fish swim by, losing out on millions of dollars. For Washington and Oregon, the top priority is making sure there are enough fish returning to honor their obligations under treaties with local tribes and under the Endangered Species Act, Swanton says. The rest is then parceled out among commercial and recreational fisheries along the West Coast. Usually, when the committee that generates the abundance index disagrees, it's called the Chinook Technical Committee, the issue is kicked up to the commissioners. And that's where it sits now. But Swanton says there's no agreement yet on how to manage the fishery without an abundance index.
So what I've asked the Southern commissioners is, what do you think we should do? I mean, given that we don't have any guidance, given that the commission did not offer any alternative options for Alaska in configuring our fisheries, what should we do?
KCAW left messages for the three voting commissioners from Washington and Oregon who didn't respond by press time. Given all this, I asked the question on many local minds. Can Southeast expect to go fishing for king salmon this summer?
I am hopeful that that will be the case, yes.
But it's not for sure right now.
Nothing's for sure right now, but I'm very, very optimistic that we will find a way through this impasse at this point in time and that we can get folks doing what they do this time of the year.
And fishermen across Southeast are hoping for the same thing. In Sitka, I'm Rachel Waldholtz.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message is sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
The Mat-Su Borough government planned to meet individually with residents who evacuated the Sockeye Fire this afternoon to tell them if their homes are still standing. Some already know. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer spoke with one Willow resident whose home survived the fire, but everything else on his property is gone.
John Basler and family have lived in Willow almost 20 years in a hand-built house ringed by several outbuildings. Last Sunday morning, they snapped photos of a new shed completed only the day before, then lingered to take shots of the whole place under a blue, cloudless sky. Not long after, they noted smoke rising northward.
The wind was blowing south, and the fire was north of us by a couple of miles, and we knew right there that we might be in danger.
The plumes of smoke got larger and closer. Basler set a sprinkler on the roof as burning pieces of spruce cone fell on his property.
They're like bombs. They go up immediately, and they're just fire bombs. And we can hear all these little something hitting all the vehicles, all of my outbuildings, everything. We can hear it, and you can feel it on your skin.
Basler's wife was grabbing stuff at random when a trooper came by to warn of a possible evacuation. 20 minutes later, the trooper was back. "Get out now," he said.
I never realized that something like that, it's tremendous. Your thoughts are... they're rampaging. You are just, you're more concentrating on getting any animals out, any people out. The rush of that is horrible. It's horrible because your mind is just so scattered. You don't know what to do. You grab what you can.
The fire, racing a mile a minute, pushed them to a neighborhood below Willow and a sleepless night. On Monday, Basler returned to his property.
The house was still standing. I was able to get in the house, grab my insurance papers, everything that I needed for all my vehicles, the house, everything. So I grabbed all the insurance papers, and then a fire truck came along and said, "Get out." It reflared back up.
Before and after photos tell the tale. The house is now ringed by ashes, charred debris, and melted pieces of metal. Surprisingly, a green tree and a few bushes are scattered through the black. Basler says he thinks fire retardant saved the house. Right now, he's staying with relatives. He says he's waiting to get back into the Willow neighborhood, but only to get a few small items he can salvage. He says he's done with Alaska and won't rebuild.
Because I built my house from the ground up. I don't want to go back there. There's a lot of memories that are there. And they're gone. They're all gone. Whether the house stands or not, I don't care. They're all gone. I have no reason to stay anymore.
It's the years of living there that's lost, he says, the moments that make a family.
There's a lot of blood, sweat, and tears and special little notes in the walls that I wrote for my boys and mom and dad and all that stuff. And it's all gone, whether the house is there or not. I lost my livelihood out there because they kept the house. But all my work tools, everything, all my hand tools, everything that I enjoy doing was demolished in the fire. I wish they would have just let the house go too. I really do.
That Willow neighborhood was our world, he says, and he'll rebuild elsewhere. Sockeye Fire evacuees at the Red Cross Houston shelter are anxious to get back to their property. Spokeswoman Beth Bennett says some may not be prepared for the emotional impact of what they find. The agency is providing counseling support at the shelter. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Kids from several villages and Fairbanks are gathered in the Yukon River community of Tanana this weekend for a basketball camp that seeks to do more than just help young people brush up on their bucket skills. The training is being conducted by Damon Bell Holter, a young man who grew up in Heidelberg, played basketball in Ketchikan, and knows well the struggles that some kids in rural Alaska experience. Cynthia Erickson got the event lined up. She lives in the Athabascan community of Tanana and works with young people struggling with abuse and addiction in their families.
So it's just a, you know, inspiring opportunity for all of these kids, and everything I've heard about Damon and his camps are just really, really positive.
She says 40 kids are attending from Manly, Fairbanks, and Victanana and other communities. She says she's pleased with the high turnout, which is more than the entire student body of the Tanana School. Erickson says Damon heard of the presentation that young people from Tanana made to the AFN convention in Anchorage last year. They spoke out about the pain of dysfunction in their families and communities, and he reached out to Erickson, wanting to help. Holter played for the Celtics and now plays for a team in Turkey. He started sponsoring the camps to help kids know they can aspire to better outcomes for their lives. Erickson says during the weekend they'll hand out pledge cards that ask kids to honor and protect themselves and others and stand together to stop suicide.
On the back of it, it has the need help keeping your pledge, contact Caroline, and then it has the 800 number on it. So we hand that out at all of the things that the kids go to, and we tell them, you know, put your name on there, take that pledge. If you have trouble, there's a number on there to call.
Erickson formed a 4-H group a few years back to start getting kids into positive activities, but she said some are dealing with such trauma, cutting themselves or contemplating suicide, that she instead formed a nonprofit called My Grandma's House. She says the idea that it's bad luck to talk about suicide is wrong. Erickson says it must be discussed, and that won't promote more self-harm, but she prepares the young people she works with for the prospect of future suicides.
It's not because we've started talking about it. We're saving. If we lose one, that's a day we'll have to deal with. But we really are changing the way things have been.
She says there hasn't been a suicide in Tanana in 5 years, but she's dealt with more than that number in her own life, and the trooper shootings in Tanana last year took a heavy emotional toll on the community. Erickson says she tells the kids it took decades of dysfunction to get to this point, and it will take time to turn it around. But she stresses it's not difficult to help kids feel better about themselves. It doesn't take money. It takes time.
We'll be picking berries and cutting moose meat or jarring fish. They're just tickled to do anything, and they feel so good. They bring their jam home, or we do raffles, and they do a little jam basket, and they just enjoy the time and the learning, and that's the whole missing link. Is the key to this is family and time.
Erickson says the Damon Bell Holters basketball camp will work with elementary kids in the mornings and high school kids in the afternoons through the weekend. In the evenings, a community picnic, swimming, tubing, and a spaghetti feed are also planned. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Shaylin Cochran in Kenai, Zachariah Hughes in Houston, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Elizabeth Jenkins and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Rachel Waldholtz in Sitka, and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Raven Alaska, connecting Alaska's business travelers across the state for more than 50 years. Find more at flyraven.com.
And by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Many Alaskans who die in boating accidents don't die of hypothermia. Without a life jacket, drowning kills long before hypothermia does. More at pledgetolive.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Garrison Keillor, one of the most beloved radio hosts and acclaimed humorists, is coming to the Alaska State Fair with his America the Beautiful tour on Sunday, August 30th at 3 p.m. This 2.5-hour show will feature Prairie Home Companion classics with piano master Richard Dworsky, sound effects man Fred Newman, and other special guests. Tickets at alaskastatefair.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska State Fair.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.